Resume company. Okay. Can you all hear me? See me? We're good. Excellent. All right. Then we are jumping in. Now, if I manage to get through everything I have intended to get through, which I did this morning, so it is doable, then this will bring this whole unit to a close, and this will be our last class for the break for the summer until we break or resume after summer break. If we have to throw in an extra class next week, we can, but my goal is to kind of bring it all together tonight. So hold on to your hats, because here
I
we go.
wish you well.
Because here we go. Okay. Shmuel Bet Perek Tet Zayin. Now, actually, there's a source page too. I think I did not share that source page. So let me pull that up here in case you want it. All right. So let me pull that source page to here. Come on. My computer gets very sluggish when I go on Zoom. Okay. Does everybody see that in the chat? Okay. That's for you if you want to have a copy of it. Otherwise, it'll all appear on the screen. We're good. Okay. So last week we talked about David and we finished the story of Mephibosheth and Siva, and then we had the Bnei Tzviya, we all kinds of challenges, and we had Shimon ben Gera and the whole story of Shimon ben Gera, and that kind of ends with David is on his way. The people came, they arrived in the destination weary and kind of resting. And now the scene shifts. And that's where we're up to, where we're back to Avshalom as he comes to Yerushalayim. Avshalom and all of the people who were with him came to Yerushalayim. Sorry. And of course, with him was Achitophel Ito. And with him is Achitophel. Achitophel's presence is very important. And who happens to be there and greet him? Vayhi kasher ba Hushai ha'arki. When he came, Hushai ha'arki came to him, Re'eh David el Avshalom. David's friend came to Avshalom. Vayomer Hushai el Avshalom, Yechi HaMelech, Hushai proclaimed to the king, "Long live the king, long live the king." Vayomer Avshalom al Hushai, Lama, is this the kindness you pay your you, befri you repay to your friends? Why didn't you go back? Why didn't you stay with your friend? Referring, of course, to David. Vayomer Hushai al Avshalom, Lo ki asher bacha Hashem ve'am hazeh v'chol ish Yisrael lo eyeh v'itoyshev. No, I will stay with the one whom Israel has chosen and the one whom God has chosen. I will stay with him. Ve'ashenit, secondly, lemi ani evod halo lifnei b'no kasher avadeti lifnei avicha ken eyeh lefanecha. Who am I serving? I'm serving his son. I'm not serving just nobody, the prince, the heir to the throne. I served your father, so now I will serve you. And that, if you look at this little paragraph, this little pay means that that's the end of that paragraph. And so for now, we're going to look at this conversation first. Then we'll get to Achitophel. Hushai's arrival, Avshalom's arrival in Yerushalayim meets Hushai Ha'arki. He comes to this particular individual. He comes with Achitophel and is greeted by Hushai Ha'arki. So you have this moment of kind of intersection of two personalities that are both David-centered, but they could not be different in terms of their role and their mandate. Achitophel is the treasonous rebel who has gone over, who was the yoetz, who was the advisor to David, and has gone over to the side of Avshalom. And Hushai was the friend of David, Re'a David, who found David as he was leaving Yerushalayim, and David said to him, you know what, your arrival is timely. Because back a chapter ago, when David had heard, that Achitophel was amongst the conspirators, Achitophel Bakoshrim, and he said, Sakelni, prayed to God, Sakelna Tatzat Achitophel Hashem, suddenly who came to greet him? Hushai Ha'aki. And he turned to Hushai Ha'aki and he said to him, you have a very important role. I am sending you back to Yerushalayim. My apologies. Vehefartali et Atzat Achitophel. Your mandate, your job, is to defeat the council of Achitophel, to act as a foil, to be an alternative, to make sure that Achitophel's advice and counsel to Avshalom has a balance with somebody who has my best interest at heart, and so he sends Hushai back. And that's exactly what we are encountering here, that Avshalom comes to Yerushalayim together with Achitophel, and who does he greet? Who does he meet at that moment? Hushai Ha'aki. And Hushai Ha'aki has a challenge. Well, of course, what's his challenge? He has to convince Avshalom that his loyalty is to the kingdom. And in this case, to Avshalom. Because, of course, the suspicion is immediate. That's exactly what Avshalom says to him. Why didn't you go with David? Your loyalty, he's your friend. Why are you not there? And so Hushai has to defend his position. And the David had given him a kind of an argument to express. In this case, Hushai kind of has to develop it. And so the first thing he says to Avshalom is, Yechi HaMelech, Yechi HaMelech. Long live the king, long live the king. That phrase in itself is an important phrase. I'll come back to it in a second. Vayomer Avshalom, Avshalom says to him, why didn't you go with David? Vayomer Hushai el Avshalom, lo ki kasher asher bachar Hashem ba'am hazeh v'chol ish Yisrael lo ehyeh v'ito eshev. No, and he says, on the contrary, I will stay with the individual who has been chosen by God and chosen by the people, referring, of course, to Avshalom. But interesting observation here, and this is really where I want to start tonight, this notion, if you look carefully at the text, the word lo appears twice. It appears in square brackets with a vav and in round brackets with an aleph. You see that? That is how it appears in a Tanakh as well. This is classically referred to as a ktiv ukri, where a word in Tanakh is written one way, but pronounced another way. And there are many examples of this throughout Tanakh, where a word is written with one set of letters, but it is actually the Masoret, the tradition of how to read it, is a different tradition. In most cases, the pronunciation is different. In this particular case, the pronunciation is the same, but the meaning is radically different. Because lo eyeh means I will stay with him, whoever God chooses and the people choose, I will stay with him. Lo with an aleph means I will not stay with him. So that's a completely different meaning in this context. So the Mefarshim, interestingly, and there's a, I've given you this on the source page as well, this reference to lo iya and lo eya, lo iya and lo eya. The Mefarshim suggest that, for example, the Radak, that ktib ba'alef ktib ba'vav, it's written with an aleph, it's read with a vav, and its meaning is derech tmiha. In other words, if I wanted to interpret the text as written, the way I would read it is, the one whom God chose and the people have chosen, should I not stay with him? Lo eyeh, right? Should I not, lo eyeh, right? Should I not stay with him? Whereas the way it's written is the simple reading, v'akri ke mashma'o. On the other hand, there is in this dual language, I think, a kind of a hint to a much deeper tension. And that deeper tension is what is really going on in Hushai's own mind. And on the one hand, he's saying to Avshalom, whoever God chooses, that's where I will stay. That's exactly what he says. But b'piv mashma hadavar she'amo klapei Avshalom, his mouth says exactly what I just described. But b'libo, says the Marikara, but b'libo gomer hadavar omro klapei David, she'nivchal ha'machut. In his heart, he doesn't mean Avshalom. In his heart, he really means, who is the one God chose, and whom is the one who the people chose? Really, that is David. So he's saying to Avshalom, you are the one who God chose, you are the one who the people chose, but he really means the one whom God chose, meaning Avshalom. Sorry, meaning David. So it's actually, there's a very similar kind of phenomenon in a pasuk in Malachim. And here, the story here is Elisha, who was sent to tell the king of a foreign nation, Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, that he was sick and he was going to, and that God was going to heal him from this illness he was going to live. That was the message he was sent to tell him. But in fact, God had said to Elisha that he is in fact going to die. So Vayomer Elav Elisha, Elisha says to the king, Ben-Hadad, he says to him, Lech emor lo chayot tichyeh. Go say to Ben-Hadad, you're going to live. Emor lo, say to him. But in fact, here, Ani Hashem ki mot yamut. But really, God has shown me that he's going to die. So the Radak points out that the Aleph Vav discrepancy here is exactly this. His intention is that, in fact, lo yichye will not live, whereas what he said to him was, amar lo chayot yichye, he said to him, you will live. So the language here flips to reflect both what's in his heart, what truth deep beneath the surface, and what he actually articulates. So that is exactly the same thing with David. Right, what Hushai says to Avshalom is, the one whom God chose, with him I shall be, meaning Avshalom. But in his mind, he really means, if it's Avshalom, lo eye, I'm not going to remain with him. So it's a fascinating reflection of the deeper tension at this moment. Sorry, just needed to take care of some background noise. All right, so that's one part of the picture. The other part of the picture is this phrase, Yechi HaMelech, Yechi HaMelech, long live the king. What is the, this phrase is also interesting. In today's language, the phrase, long live the king, is used anytime you kind of give honor to the king, right? At the coronation ceremony or any kind of significant moment, right? Long live the king. Long live the queen is part of the national anthem of oh, God bless the queen, oh, God bless the king in the case of England. But nonetheless, this notion of Yechi HaMelech is an interesting phrase. In Tanakh, it is not uncommon. It appears, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different places in Tanakh. But all of them have a similar context. And it's the context that is worthy of note. The first place that phrase appears is, of course, by the first king. Right? You're not going to have it before you have a king. Who's the first king of Israel? Who was the first king of Israel?
Shaul.
So when Shaul is coronated, when Shaul is designated as the king, if you remember way back to Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud, remember back that far, Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud was, there was a whole ceremony after Shmuel had chastised the people for requesting a king, and they find Shaul is designated, there's a lot that is drawn in public to demonstrate to the people that this is chosen by God. And the lot falls on the tribe of Benjamin, and then the lot falls on the house of Kish, and then it falls on Shaul ben Kish. Vayivakshu v'lo nimtza. They looked for him and they could not find him. So they asked God, is there somebody else? And God answered, he said, Hinei nechma alakelim. He's over there. He's hiding amongst the baggage. Go find him. He's hiding. Doesn't want to be here. So they run and they bring him and they stand him before the people. Head and shoulders towering above the rest. And Shmuel says to the people, can you see? This is the one who God has chosen. There's nobody like him. The people all shouted out and proclaimed, Yechi HaMelech, long live the king. And so from that moment, you then have a series of moments when the phrase Yechi HaMelech appears. For example, the next time, other than here, by Avshalom, where the phrase appears is in Malachim Aleph, Perek Aleph. What's going on in Malachim Aleph, Perek Aleph, is the challenge to Shlomo's choice as king, a challenge posed by the other son of David, namely Adoniyahu. And Adoniyahu proclaimed himself as king, and there is a whole... Adoniyahu ben Chagit mitnaseh lemor, ani amloch. Adoniyahu said, I'm going to be king. And David and Natan and Bathsheba come running to David. They have to deal with this. They have to respond. And so in describing what is taking place, we find the following reference. Natan, speaking to David, says that Adoniyahu has gone down this day, and he sacrificed all kinds of offerings. He's called over the king's sons and the officers, and Eviatar Kohen, and they're all eating and drinking and celebrating, and proclaiming, Yechi HaMelech Adoniyahu, long live King Adoniyahu. So David is very moved, and David immediately instructs them to do differently and to anoint Shlomo. And so Shlomo needs to be anointed. So David tells his Natan and Bathsheba, take Shlomo right away, take him down into the valley, Mashachato Sham, and there you will anoint him, and there you will proclaim him king over Israel. Utkatem b'shofar v'amartem, Yechi HaMelech Shlomo, and proclaim, long live King Shlomo. All of these, by the way, are on the source page. So if you're looking for the references, I put all these sources on the source page as well. I'm just pulling them from here because it's easier to see the context. The last case is the case of, I'm not going to go through the whole story, but the last case is, if you remember the story of Ataliah. Ataliah is we keep coming back to her story. One of these days we're going to actually have to learn it inside because it's such a dramatic moment in Tanakh. Ataliah is the wicked witch of Tanakh. She is the daughter of Ahab and Izebel. She is the one who murders the entire royal family of David, every last one of the house of David, so that she could reign over the entire unified house of Israel and Judah together. She just kind of moves herself into the position of queen. For 7 years, everybody thinks that the house of David has been destroyed until they discover that there was one tiny baby was saved from that bloodbath from Ataliah. And they bring the baby out into the temple courtyard itself. They place upon this baby the crown and the testimony, they made him king, they anointed him, and they clapped, and they said, long live the king. So, coming back to my story, what's the point? Yechi HaMelech appears in five places in Tanakh, but all of them have the same characteristic, namely,
not the right person.
A challenge to the throne. Right? A challenge. It could be the right person. Shlomo was the right person. Right? But a challenge. It's a proclamation that there's a challenge to the throne. And therefore, there's a recognition of who the king should be. Whether the rightful king or the wrongful king. In Yoash's case, the rightful king. In Shlomo's case, the rightful king. In In Adoniyahu's case, the wrong king. In Shaul's case, he himself had challenged. He didn't want to be the king, so there was that challenge. But there's always a challenge. And so when Hushai comes, when Avshalom shows up in Yerushalayim, and Hushai says to him, Yechi HaMelech, that's not an arbitrary phrase of respect, long live the king. Sorry about that. Right? That's a declaration of an acknowledgement of Avshalom's position as king. What he's saying to Avshalom is, I recognize you as king, Yechi HaMelech. Not only that, he does something unique. Of all the references to you, the phrase Yechi HaMelech that appears so far, all of them have made that declaration once. Hushai is the only place we find that statement duplicated. Yechi HaMelech, Yechi HaMelech. Now, I mean, I'm not going to go so far as to suggest, because I don't think it's pshat, that he's saying it twice because he means once for Avshalom and once for David. I don't think he's that complicated. I think what he means is to emphasize it. Avshalom is launching this rebellion against none other than David HaMelech. Comes along Hushai, whose loyalty has been to David, and he's here in this moment trying to demonstrate to Avshalom that in fact his loyalty is to the position of the king and not to the person who holds that office. So he says twice, Yechi HaMelech, Yechi HaMelech. And in fact, maybe that's why Avshalom's response is to say to him that aren't you Rea David? But he says that also twice. Vayomer Avshalom el Hushai, zeh chazdechat reyecha, that's your kindness to your friend. Lama lo alachta et reyecha? You say Yechi HaMelech twice. I could tell you, right? Your Rea, your friend, is David twice over. So where is your loyalty to David? And if your loyalty is to David, then not only are you lying in your loyalty to me, but then you become very suspicious. And at that point, Hushai launches into his rationale. How is he going to convince convince Avshalom that he is sincere? Vayomer Hushai al Avshalom. He says two things. Number one, lo yasher bachar Hashem be'am hazeh v'chol ish Yisrael lo eyev ito hashef. The one whom God has chosen, the one whom the people have chosen, there I will be and with him I will stay. Point one. Point two, v'ashenit, l'mi ani avod alo lifnei b'no, kasher avadeti lifnei avicha, ken eyeh lefanecha. Should I not serve before his son? Served your father, I'll serve you. Meaning, let's break it down into two separate messages here. Right? Number one, his argument that his role as Rea David is no different than Achitophel's role as Yoetz David. Remember, Achitophel also had a role with David. So why should Hushai be any different than Achitophel? Leaving aside the issue of Achitophel's familial status with Bathsheba, right? Bathsheba's grandfather. But otherwise, right, Avshalom went out of his way to bring Achitophel into the rebellion, into his conspiracy, because he wanted Achitophel's position as, it's called, chief of staff, right? Chief advisor to the king. Well, Rea David was also an important position, but it was an official position. He wasn't just Stam Rea David. He was an official role. And that official role was, if one of them was the chief of staff, so the other was the security council advisor or some other role, right? It wasn't that he was just a friend of David. He had an official position. The Rea was an official position, just as the Yoetz was an official position. And that's his argument to Avshalom. He says, I'm no different than Achitophel. I serve the Malchus. I serve the king. I serve whoever's in that position. If it's David, I'll serve David. If it's somebody else whom the people have chosen and somebody else whom God has chosen, then him I will serve and with him I will be. Lo yeh v'toyshev. That's one argument. The second argument is designed to be a more personal comment, which is, L'mi ani evod halo lifnei b'no, kasher avadet lifnei avicha ken eye lefanecha. Meaning, the second argument is, what's the second argument? It's in many ways much more powerful, much more potent in its impact. What he says to Avshalom essentially is, he takes the wind out of the sail. Because what is he arguing here?
Right. I serve your father, therefore I shall serve you.
That's what he says, but what's the implication of that? What implication does that present to him politically?
Succession's taken place already. Essentially, it's as if David has abdicated.
David has abdicated. Right? In other words, what he's suggesting here, which is insightful and remarkable and powerful, is, wait a second, this isn't a rebellion. This isn't a merit, right? You are the son. Your father was the king, and you are the son to the king. You are the heir to the throne. You are the Ben. You are the crown prince. Why shouldn't I serve you? I served your father. I'll serve you. Right? We have a transition of power. The transition of power went from David to Avshalom. Transitions of power can be very peaceful, can be very natural, and all the people who served in the previous administration can certainly transfer over to serve in the next administration because they're loyal to the administration. This is not a rebellion. It's not like I'm jumping ship and abandoning all my years of service to David. You are his son. You are the successor to that position. I'm loyal to David as I'm loyal to you. And suddenly it's about how he's perceiving Avshalom's arrival in Yerushalayim. Here is Avshalom ready for battle. He comes with all of his people, and he comes with Achitophel, and he's ready for a battle, and he's ready to challenge David. And what does he find? David is gone. David is gone. I don't think he anticipated that David would be gone. And in his place, he finds a throne ready for succession. And that's precisely what Hushai says to him. I'm here to serve the Melech. It's really an extraordinary moment. And he manages to find, in many ways, he manages to hit on Avshalom's weak link. Avshalom's weakness is his exposure to flattery, to the kavod, to the fact that he wants to be king. David didn't want to be king, and Shaul didn't want to be king. Avshalom desperately wants to be king. And so he kind of just feeds into that. And he says to him, it's all yours, right? David is not here. David has left it to you. You are now the king. And he's ready for a fight. He's ready to claim that he's going to be the prince and the heir to the throne. And David is going to be the king in name only, but he's going to be the rightful heir to that throne. And suddenly he arrives in Yerushalayim I have the throne. I'm not fighting for the position of the heir to the throne. I'm the king. I am the throne. Oh, that's new. That's different. And that throws it. So that's how Hushai kind of sets up this moment. And if Hushai thinks this, and if David has left, and Hushai is there, and Hushai is claiming that the throne is a succession, and that David has abandoned Yerushalayim, and that David has left, and he's the legitimate heir to the throne. If that's Hushai's argument, then that's certainly the argument of the people. And so it kind of, Avshalom gets inflated. Here he is, ready to go. And Hushai just feeds into that moment. And of course, what is he going to do? Challenge Hushai? Now he's going to say, no, Hushai, you're wrong. This is not a succession. This is a rebellion when David is nowhere to be seen. Right? He's fighting a ghost. So Hushai, it's a brilliant tactic on Hushai's part. And the whole point of it is to set up Hushai's ability to be ready to be trusted by Achitofel, by Avshalom, as an alternative vision of how to solidify his throne. This is the key piece. I'm going to say it again. What Hushai does is he establishes himself, his credentials, to be a legitimate perspective or foil to Achitofel in presenting to Avshalom a vision of how to establish his throne. Achitofel is going to take Avshalom down one path, and then at some point or another, Avshalom is going to turn to Hushai and say to Hushai, "What do you think?" And he's going to say, "Well, my years of experience with David has led me to think that there's a different path that you should take." And that's going to be the challenge. So Achitofel will be left, so Avshalom will be left with two advisors, Achitofel and Hushai, and exactly in the right place at the right time, not in this chapter, but in the next chapter, to do exactly what David has asked of him, which is to foil the plot of Achitofel. So that's the setup that Hushai has established for himself. Which brings us to the next piece of the story. Yomer Avshalom el Achitofel. Avshalom says to Achitofel, Havu lachem eitza manase. Give your counsel. What shall we do? Now, we'll talk about what Achitofel suggests to him in a second, because it's really quite extraordinary. But I just want to make the one observation. Havu lachem is in the plural. In the English translation, you lose it because English has lost the distinction between singular and plural in second person. Old English still had that, but if I read this in Old English, it would sound like Chaucer. But anyway, but Hebrew has that plural. So who is he talking to? He's talking to Achitofel, and yet he says Havu lachem in the plural. So the Mefarshim again pick up on these kinds of language nuances and various suggestions. Radak says that it's Lashon Tiferet. It's kind of like the equivalent of sort of flowery language. It's like the equivalent of a royal we, but in the second person. And he's talking to Achitofel, and he refers to him in the plural. Or it could mean, as Radak and Abravanel suggest, that it's you and the council, you and the elders, you and the Chachamim, you and the Zkenim, meaning Achitofel sat at the head of the Sanhedrin, or the equivalent of the Sanhedrin. What do you and the advisors think, right? What do you and the cabinet think? And he's chief of staff. So what do you and the staff think should be the approach of this malchus? It's also possible, and the Mefarshim don't say this, but I think it's not an impossibility, that who's the plural? Achitofel and
Hushai.
Exactly. Because they're both there. And they're both in a position now to be advisors to the king. On the other hand, he's heard from Hushai, and now he turns to Achitofel and says, "Okay, Achitofel, what do you guys think? Meaning, are you on the same page? Are you thinking something else?" Right? And Hushai will not respond to this. Hushai does not enter into the rest of the conversation. The rest of this perek, with all story of the Pilegesh and the Shlomo and the suggestion to Avshalom that he takes his father's Pilegesh and sleep with them, etc. It's a horrible, horrible story. We'll come to it in a second. Hushai has nothing to do with that. Right? Hushai is nowhere to be seen. But there's a hint that he's still standing there. So what does Achitofel say? Here's the Eitzah. Take your father's concubines. He left them to keep the house. All of Israel will hear that you shamed your father. And that will strengthen the hands of all who are with you. Take your father's concubines. That's Achitofel's suggestion, which is quite an extraordinary suggestion, considering the fact that that's not what Avshalom asked him. For advice, for counsel, some what? How to wage the war? How do I sit on that throne? Even the question is odd, right? What's the question based on? Why does he even need a counsel? Why does he need an etza? Why? What's he concerned about? He needs an etza. What does he need an etza for? Because, and again, it comes back to the same point that Hushai made. I don't think Achitov, I don't think Avshalom anticipated that he was coming to Yerushalayim to be king. I think he anticipated that he was coming to Yerushalayim to stake his claim as the heir to the throne. David will remain for as an old man for a couple of years, do whatever he needs to do, but in the affairs of state, Avshalom would run the country. And then eventually he would die, and David would go, pass on, and Avshalom would be the king. Avshalom wanted to stage a full-scale war. He wanted to stake his claim as heir to the throne. But what happened when he got to Yerushalayim? David pulled all the cards out, pulled the carpet out from underneath him. David pulled all the cards out because David ran. David left Yerushalayim. And in leaving Yerushalayim, he's put Avshalom into a very interesting position. Avshalom arrived in Yerushalayim ready to stake a claim as the heir to the throne, only to find that he's now the throne. Right? He's now the first. Avshalom doesn't know the first thing about being king. He's never been in any role as the crown prince whose job it is to learn how to be king. That's not an easy thing to do. Look how many years it took for King Charles to train how to be king of England, right? Talking to Canadians, I can make a reference like that. Right? But Avshalom walks into Yerushalayim, and suddenly David is not there. And so he turns to Achitophel and he says, what do I do? David is on the run. David is now on the run can be a good thing because it leaves Avshalom in the palace. But on the run can also be a dangerous thing because on the outside, David has the ability to pull together a rebellion, pull together an opposition. So Achitophel's question is twofold. What do I do to be king? And what do I do to draw a line in the sand and make sure that no rebellion gets launched against my authority? And Achitophel's response to us sounds shocking, but to Avshalom sounded perfectly reasonable. And I want to explain, we're going to devote the rest of today's shiur to understanding what this request was about. Vayomer Achitophel al Avshalom, bo el pilakshei avicha. Take your father's concubines. Come to your father. Right? Sleep with your father's, let's put it in the very clear language. Sleep with your father's concubines. And all of Israel will know that you shamed your father, kinivashta tavicha, and that will strengthen your hand, v'chazku yudeg kol asher itach. And that's exactly what Avshalom does, v'yatul Avshalom ha'ol alagag. So he took a tent, pitched it at the top of the roof, v'yavo Avshalom ha'pilakshe aviv, he took his father's concubines, and he slept with them, le'enei kol Yisrael, in the eyes, height of all of Israel, just to be clear. Eneko Yisrael is the ohel, it's the tent. The actual act is inside the tent. I just want to make that clear to everybody, right? That's not so important. But that is the Eitzah that Achitophel gives to Avshalom. Achitophel's counsel, which he gave in those days, were equal to the counsel of the word of God. That's how revered, that's how respected Achitophel's advice was, both to David and Avshalom. So, of course, Avshalom does exactly what Achitophel suggested, maybe almost exactly. We'll see if he changed it in some way. But what is the significance of this declaration? How on earth does that respond or react in any way to Achitophel's dilemma that here he was preparing to be the heir to the throne and suddenly he is the king and he asks for counsel. So what we need to understand is that this is not a reflection of 20th century marital affairs. Okay, this is a biblical reference. And in the context of Tanakh, we need to understand what this concept was. Fundamental to the world of the kings and the reigns of Tanakh, very common in most ancient cultures and certainly in Israel as well, was that if you succeeded your father to the throne, amongst the things that you were entitled to was the concubines or the harem of the king. And I'll show you a couple of examples where the notion of taking the concubines of the king, now there's a difference between the Pilegish and the Isha, between the wife, former wife, which was the queen mother, and the Pilegish or the harem. Because the queen mother or the former wife of the king, that was certainly not inherited by the king, so, in any circumstance. Whereas the Pilegish, that the group of women known as the Pilegish HaMelech, they were in fact part of the that which was inherited by the next generation. Why is it relevant? So let me show you a couple of examples. And you'll see right away where this is going. Let's start with a familiar story. Why is it familiar? Because we learned it within the last couple of years, maybe. Okay, let's go back to Shmuel Bet Perek Gimel. Shmuel Bet Perek Gimel is the story of the rebellion or the war between David and the son of Shaul by the name of Ishbosheth. Actually, I'm going to stop sharing for a second so I can talk. If you remember when Shaul died on Mount Gilboa and there was a momentary question as to who would be king. So David goes to Hebron and there they make him king over the tribe of Judah. And the rest of the tribes of Israel from Benjamin north stayed loyal to the son of Shaul by the name of Ishbosheth. Remember? And there was a big civil war. There was a big war. That was a war in which Abishai, in which Yoav ben Tsruya was the general of David, and Avner ben Ner was the general, the power behind the throne. Avner ben Ner, who was Shaul's general, had sided with Ishbosheth and essentially built the army to defend Ishbosheth and lead the army. And Ishbosheth was a very weak individual. The power behind that moment was clearly in the hands of Avner ben Ner. At some point or another, Avner changes sides and he goes over to David and he says, I will change sides and become loyal to you. David accepts that moment and Yoav rejects it. Yoav goes out and kills him for it. And that story we've looked at a number of times. What was the catalyst to Avner changing sides? Anybody remember? So let's take a look at it. Ma'i biyad milchama ben bet Shaul uven bet David. Came to pass a great war between the house of Shaul and the house of David. Ve'avner yam mitchazek bevet Shaul. And Avner was strong in the house of Shaul, was becoming stronger. U'l'Shaul pilegesh u'shma ritzba bat aya. Shaul had a Pilegish. Her name was Ritzpah Bat Aya. Ritzpah Bat Aya we actually just recently encountered because she's the one who looked after the bodies of the sons of Shaul after the story of the Givonim. But that's later, historically. At this point, we're just introduced to Pilegish of Shaul by the name of Ritzpah Bat Aya. Vayome el Avner. So Ishbosheth says to Avner, why did you sleep with my father's concubine? Evidently, this Ritzpah Bat Aya and Avner had a relationship, which wasn't in secret so much. Avner's reaction to this accusation was furious. Al divrei Ishbosheth. He was furious. Vayomer. Now listen carefully to what he says in his reaction. Arosh kelev anochi? Am I a dog's head? Shiliuda? Am I the Judah's dog yet? Today I do a kindness to the house of Shaul, your father. El echav el mereyu, to his brothers, to his friends. Veloim tziticha biyad David, I haven't delivered you into the hands of David. Vatifkod alai avon aishayam, and then you come and charge me today with a fault concerning a woman? Ko yaseh elokim lav nevecho yosif lo ki kashen nishba Hashem le David ki ken eseh lo lavira mamlacha mibeit shaul lakim et kiseh David. You know what? I don't need you and I don't need your loyalty. I'm going over to David. I'll take the kingdom and I'll take all the tribes of Israel. You think you're the power behind the throne. I'm the power behind the throne. I'll take them all and I'll run to David. You're gone. You're done. And that's exactly what he does. Now notice, what does he not say to Ishbosheth? What does he not say to Ishbosheth?
He doesn't answer the question.
Well, he sort of does. He says, I'm the power behind the throne. I made you king. I can destroy you as king. And because I made you as king, I'm entitled to the king's pilegesh. Who's the power behind the throne? You or me? It's exactly what he says. What he doesn't do is he doesn't deny it. In 2023, such an accusation you deny right away, right? This is not 2023. This is Tanakh. He didn't deny it because it was true. But it was true not because they were having an affair. It was true because Avner felt himself entitled as the power of the throne to take the pilegesh of the king. And when Ishbosheth wouldn't agree, so Ishbosheth said, okay, the tech with you, I'm going over to David. Say another interesting story. They're subtle because they're all moments of tension, but that's exactly what's going on. Here's another story. Let's actually jump to Melachim Aleph Perek Bet. Melachim Aleph Perek Bet, chapter 2, after the rebellion of Adoniyahu. Adoniyahu rebels. Adoniyahu says he's going to be king. David manages to put Shlomo on the throne instead, and the rebellion is over. At the very end of it, what happens to Adoniyahu? Adoniyahu runs to the Mizbeach. He thinks he's going to be killed. He goes running to the Mizbeach, and Shlomo says to him, I swear to you, I won't kill you. You can go under house arrest. Go. He doesn't have to be on the Mizbeach. He doesn't have to run for his life. And he can be under house arrest. So he sends Adoniyahu back to be under house arrest after Shlomo takes the throne. David is dying. David calls over his son Shlomo. David gives him a series of tasks to take care of on his death that David was unable to do. One of them, of course, was to deal with Yoav ben Tzruiah. The other was to deal with Shimei ben Gera and a few other items as well, not our subject for now. And then we find the following conversation. Listen carefully to the following conversation. David reigned for 40 years. Shlomo sat on his father's throne, but his throne was established. Adoniyahu ben Chagit came to Batsheva. Now, this is an interesting conversation. What is Adoniyahu ben Chagit going to say to Batsheva? They have a very cordial conversation. Vatomer Hashalom Boecha. Vayom Hashalom. Have you come in peace? He says, yes, I've come in peace. War is over. Rebellion is over. I'm done. No problem. I have something to say to you, Batsheva. So she says, fine, speak your peace. You know that the kingdom was almost mine. You have to put yourself into the moment. And this is Adoniyahu ben Chagit talking to Batsheva, mother of Shlomo, after the rebellion, after Shlomo spared his life, and Adoniyahu is now sitting under house arrest. And now he comes to Bathsheba. And he says, you know that I was almost king. Really, all of Israel looked to me to reign. And somehow the kingdom was turned away and given to my brother. The fact that Bathsheba was the catalyst to all of that seems to have slipped his mind. Okay. This was by God's decree. Okay, I accept it. It's by the hand of God. Bathsheba's listening for the punchline. Okay. I have only one small request. Don't deny this to me. One small request. Fine, so speak. Do me a favor. You speak to Shlomo. He won't deny you. If you make the request, he'll say yes. All I want to do is marry Avishaga Shunamit. Innocent request. So Bathsheba says, fine. I'll make the request to the king. So Bathsheba comes to the king and she speaks to him about Adoniyahu, and the king gets up to greet her, and he bows down to her. It's his mother. So he sits on his throne, and there's a throne next to him for the queen mother, Le'em HaMelech, and she sits to his right, to the king mother. I have but one small request of you, says Bathsheba to the king. Al tashevet panai, don't deny me. Shali, what is it, my mother? Shali me. I won't deny you. Ki lo shevet panayich. And she says innocently, "Vatomer yiten et Avishag Shunamit l'Adoniyahu achicha liisha." Let's make a shidduch. A shidduch between Avishag Shunamit and your brother. Sounds like a reasonable shidduch to me. Reasonable shidduch to you. Vayan Amelech Shlomo vayomer liimo. Shlomo's answer is quick and clear. Why do you make the request of Avishag? Why did you request the kingdom for him? Why don't you give away the throne too while you're at it? He's bigger than me, he's older than me. And he and Avyatar and Yoav, they all wanted the throne. Just by making this request, Adoniyahu has forfeited his life, says Shlomo, and he makes an oath. And from that point forward, Adoniyahu does not have long to live. What is going on here? It's a simple request from Adoniyahu, from Bathsheba, to marry Avishag, and suddenly Shlomo goes off the handle that this is rebellion? So, the problem with this passage is there's three psukim, there's three verses that we need to know to unlock the secret of this text. And they are the opening three psukim of the Sefer. So let's go back a perek and read the following. David is old. David is on his deathbed. David is cold. David, for whatever reason, they bring him a companion, and that companion is Avishag HaShunamit. They sought a beautiful young woman. They thought that would solve David's problem, and they brought Avishag HaShunamit to the king as a sochenet, companion, shechva b'chekecha, that she should lie in his bosom. And the woman was very beautiful. She became the king's companion and served him. Listen carefully to the next three words. V'amelech lo yida'a. The king did not know her intimately. The king did not sleep with her. The king did not touch her. This was the device of whoever were the servants of the king thought that would solve his problem. That would be the solution to David. And David knew very well where they were coming from and refused to lay a finger on Avishag. So let me ask you a question. What was the status of Avishag HaShunamit? Was she the king's concubine? She was the king's sochenet. She was brought to the Shechta B'chekecha. But on the other hand, it says that the king didn't touch her. V'amelech lo yada.
So but did others know that?
Nobody knows that.
So they all think that she's
nobody pilengish. Knows it. So from everybody's perspective, she's the king's pilengish. I wouldn't say nobody knows that. I would say there's a handful of people who do know that the Amelech lo yada'a. And I can tell you who they are. They are the following list of people who know that Avishag HaShunamit was not the king's pilegish. Shlomo, Batsheva, and Adoniyahu. I assume about Avishag as well. Okay, we'll throw her into on the list. So here's the conversation. Adoniyahu comes to Batsheva and says innocently, "David never touched her. She doesn't have the status of the Pilegesh. She's therefore no different than any other young girl in the kingdom. I'm entitled to have some happiness in my life," she says to Tevye, right? Let me marry Avishag. Wonderful Shidduch, Avishag, she's a wonderful girl, Adoniyahu, part of the kingdom. We'll make a big wedding, it'll be a wonderful Shidduch. Make a chasna, make a chuppah. Comes to Shlomo HaMelech, and Shlomo HaMelech understood exactly what Adoniyahu was planning. Because to Adoniyahu, it was his last effort to pull the rug from underneath Shlomo. Because the moment he marries Avishag, what does he proclaim? I am the heir to the king's Pilegesh. Shlomo understood it. But Sheva didn't understand it because Sheva's in a different world. But David understood it. But Shlomo understood it. And Adoniyahu understood it. That's the meaning of in the context of Tanakh, the variable of taking the Pilegesh of the king was a declaration of rule, of taking over the monarchy, or taking over the leadership. That's what it meant. And that's precisely what Achitofel says to, go back to our story, that's precisely what Achitofel says to Avshalom, Bo el Pilegesh Avicha. The Pilegshim are there, and you are the king. So you are entitled. Which is more or less along the lines of what Hushai had said. You are the king, you are the heir to the throne, which is one of the reasons why Hushai can't respond to this request, because it fits exactly into the line that Hushai had said, which is you are the heir to the throne, you are the legitimate king. So Achitofel says, well, if you're the legitimate king, here's one of the things that legitimate kings do, is they inherit the heir to the concubines of the king. By the way, there's one more story that's related to the same phenomenon. Anybody know what it is? There are four places in Tanakh where the story of the Pilegesh HaMelech as a kind of a symbol of continuity appears. We talked about Shmuel, about Mispa Bataya, we talked about Daniel, and our story here is one more. Anybody know what it is?
Well, it's not about a king, but it reminds me of what Reuven did.
Oh, that's exactly what it is.
That's what I was going to say.
That is exactly what it is. That is the story of Reuven. And I want to show you that because I think it's extraordinary. The story of Reuven is the end of Bereishit Perek Lamed Hei. Now understand that what's happening here is Perek Lamed Dalet is the story of Dinah. Perek Lamed Dalet, Lamed Gimel, is Yaakov coming back from the house of Lavan. And he greets Esav, and he bows to Esav seven times. And they embrace each other, and they kiss each other. And Yaakov says to Esav, it's all yours. You can have the whole, I give the whole 9 yards. You can have the whole bracha. And then they come to Shechem, and Leah goes out, and Dinah goes out, and Dinah encounters what she encounters, and the response to Dina's circumstance is that the brothers defend her and Yaakov does not. And that's a source of tension within the family. And finally, Shimon and Levi take matters into their own hands, and they go and they slaughter the entire city. And when Yaakov challenges them, Ayomer Yaakov el Shimon ve Levi, achartem oti, you have caused me trouble, you made me repugnant amongst the people, hashvish eini biyoshev haaretz, to dwell in this land, because you have gone out and done this terrible thing. And their response, Vayomru achzonaya setachotainu, should we let our sister become a prostitute? That's what you want us to do? Let her not defend her? And there's no answer to that question. Because Yaakov's essentially in his role as leadership role, it's done. So the next pasuk, Vayomer Elokim and Yaakov kum el Beit El, so Yaakov has to go to Beit El, and there he has to remove all the other, there's also about the idols. I'm going to skip the story of the idols. And there's Zimitza the Malach. Okay. And then we find the following pasuk. Vayi bishkon Yisrael ba'aretz ahi, as we dwelt, as Yaakov dwelt in that land, Vayelech Reuven vayishkav et Bilha Bilegesh Aviv. Reuven went and slept with Bilha, his father's Pilegesh. Vayishma Yisrael, and Yaakov heard. Vayubnei Yaakov shnemasa. And the Mefarshim go all kinds of mental acrobatics in order to deal with the text and say that he really didn't do it. All he did was move the bed. He was really trying to defend the honor of Rachel. All kinds of stories in order to kind of avoid dealing with the text as a text. But there are Rishonim who say you deal with the text as a text. Why would Reuven do such a horrible thing? That's ridiculous. Well, what's the next parak? Get Ela told it Asa for a second, because that's not irrelevant. That's a parenthetical parak. The next parak of significance, forget the Ela told it Asa. The next parak is Vayeshev Yaakov Be'eretz Megurei Aviv. Yaakov is in his dwelling, beginning of Parsha Vayeshev. Yaakov loved Yosef, and he made for him Ektonet Pasim, a coat of Pasim. Anybody remember who else wore Ektonet Pasim?
Adam Harisha.
In the Medrash, but in the text of Tanakh, Tamar, Amnon and Tamar, she had a ktonet pasim that she, which was a beged of kingship, of malucha, and she tore it after the story with Amnon. A ktonet pasim was a garment of malchus. What essentially Yaakov did is he chose Yosef as the heir to his malucha. Because what's going on at this period, at this moment in time in Sefer Bereishit, is a conflict over who is going to take over for Yaakov. And the conflict was between Reuven, Shimon and Levi, Yehuda, and Yosef. Reuven chose to act and to claim the leadership, which was the standard. Unfortunately, we don't understand it in our world, but that's what they did. You took your father's pilegesh. You said, I'm the heir to the throne. And when that was so disgusting to Yaakov that wrote Reuven off of the equation, Shimon and Levi had already written themselves out of the equation, that left Yehuda and Yosef. Well, Yaakov chose. And he chose Yosef. And of course, everybody else chose you. And then the rest of the story, as we say, is history. But that's exactly the same message that Achitophel gives to Avshalom. This was standard. This was not an absurd suggestion. This was an extreme suggestion, but it had a rationale to it. The rationale was proclaim yourself king in a way in which is not reversible. And Rashi makes an interesting observation on this pasuk. When Rashi says, "What is v'chazku yedei kol asher itach?" You'll strengthen the hands of all that are with you. So Rashi says that atah yadam rafa. Right now they're weak. Right now the people who are there, the rank and file, they're kind of standing on the side. They don't want to get involved. Because they're afraid that this rebellion will fall, haben yitcharet etzel aviv. And if we side with you, the people will say, then when the king returns, we will be despised will have taken sides, and that will not be good. So what Shalom essentially is saying, Achitof essentially saying to Shalom, you need to draw the line in the sand. You need to make it clear the people cannot sit on the fence. They're either with you or they're against you. You need to burn the bridge behind you. This is a one-way street. You do this, there's no turning back. The people either side with you or they side with your enemies. And your enemies now include David. That's what this does. And so Avshalom does exactly as Achitophel had suggested, with one change, with one small modification. Because Achitophel is Achitophel and Avshalom is Avshalom. Achitophel's suggestion was, Boel Pilakshe Avicha, you come to your father's concubines, Bishamako Yisrael and all of Israel will hear. What does Avshalom do? Vayatu Avshalom Oel Alagag, he pitches his tent on the rooftop, and he does so le'enei kol Yisrael in plain sight. Achitophel never told Avshalom to pitch a tent on the rooftop. By the way, the same rooftop from which vantage point David initially set eyes on Bathsheba, if you're looking for the circle, full circle coming back to the story. Achitophel never said, go and pitch your tent on the roof. That's absurd. It's abhorrent. But that's Avshalom. That's all Avshalom. Now, there's an element of divine providence there. There's an element of the irony of the decree that Natan and Navi had said to him that this will, you did this in secret and this, you're, this will happen to you in public. But that's kind of behind the scenes of Avshalom's side of things. From Avshalom's perspective, this was Avshalom's way of saying to Achitophel, okay, great idea, but we're going to go and do it in even more so. You want me to do it and let the news go out the next morning in the newspapers, headline, the king marries, the Avshalom marries David's concubines. I'm not waiting for tomorrow's headlines. I'm going to make my own headlines. And he takes his tent and he pitches it on the rooftop. And everything's all fine and dandy. Everything's great. Except for one problem. One small problem. How successful was this moment of Avshalom's declaration of a line in the sand that says, this is it. I am now the king, and the David has abdicated the throne, and I will be king and we will all live happily ever after. I have the king's concubines. How successful was he at that message? So if you compare for a moment David's mindset in Perek Tetvav as he's leaving Yerushalayim, David is in a world of accepting the decree, accepting the judgment. Whatever God throws his way, he will accept. He's going into exile. He's going into exile. He is forced to abandon the ark. He'll abandon the ark. He's forced to abandon Yerushalayim. He abandons Yerushalayim. Everything that happens is he encounters Shimon ben Gera. He's forced to accept the curses of Shimon ben Gera. He's Avshalom is going to be king. Avshalom is going to be king. All because, what did we say was the primary reason David left Yerushalayim? I'm going to stop sharing for 1 second. What was the primary reason David left Yerushalayim?
He didn't want a war.
He didn't want war, right?
Right.
He did not want to fight Avshalom. He, under no circumstances was he going to fight his son for the throne. He saw the loss of the throne as much a part of the sin of the punishment for Bathsheba as everything else. If Shaul lost the throne for less, David was certainly going to lose the throne for Bathsheba. He understood that. He accepted that. He accepted upon himself the decree from the Ribbono Shel Olam that he was to lose the throne and everything was going to be handed over to Avshalom. That's how David leaves Yerushalayim. Avshalom shows up in Yerushalayim. Fine. One perek later. Not two, not five, not ten, not a lifetime later. One perek later. We find, it's a prelude to what we're going to discuss next year, Perek Yud Zayin. Vayomer Achitofel. Aini Achitofel says to Avshalom, take 12,000 soldiers and go chase after David. And he turns to Hushai. What does a Hushai think? And Hushai says, no, don't take 10,000 soldiers, 12,000 soldiers. That's not enough. Take the entire army in one fell swoop, because David is going to be hard to catch. And beginning of Perek Yilchet, Vayifkod David et ha'am asher ito, David counted all the people who were with him. And he set them as officers and captains over thousands and over hundreds, meaning the hierarchy of generals in an army that numbered in the tens of thousands. Where did David get an army of tens of thousands if he's running in exile, head between his knees, because he's running from the palace and he's refusing to fight? And Dov, if he wanted to stage a fight against Absalom, he was sitting in the capital, he was sitting in Yerushalayim, he could have done it there. Suddenly, next parak, David is, Absalom is running after David into an army, takes an entire army of Israel, of Absalom, runs out to catch David in Yar Ephraim, and David takes an army of tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and into this battle. And we'll talk about the battle. That'll be our subject for next year. But where did David get both the resolve to fight Absalom, and where did he get an army?
Obviously, people defected after this issue.
So the theory that I saw written in Bazak writes it up in his sefer, but the theory that I wanted to kind of close with was that Avshalom essentially destroys himself, because in the aftermath of this, which was designed in Achitofel's mindset to draw a line in the sand and say, from here everybody will come running to you, it'll strengthen your hand, what it does in the end is exact opposite. Suddenly the whole world knows exactly what they're dealing with. And I think even the fact that Achitofel's suggestion by itself may have been as successful, because it's happened before and it'll happen again, but Avshalom's change to the suggestion of pitching the tent on the rooftop was so anathema, it was so abhorrent to the ethos of Yerushalayim and to the mindset of the kingdom of Israel, that before you know it, one by one, group by group, doesn't take long before the attrition starts to build, and the people, the hearts of the people who may have sided with Avshalom, maybe. Remember at the end when he ran to Hebron, after Amnon Tamar, after David was not able to be judge, and he goes running to Hebron, and the hearts of the people are with him? And suddenly the hearts of the people are with David. Because suddenly the whole world understood from that tent on the rooftop of the palace with whom they were dealing, who Avshalom really was. And so by the time we get to Perek Yilchet, David is in a position both in strength and in will to launch the counteroffensive that will return David to the throne of Israel. And with that, we will stop here and bring this year's Shir series on the path to rebellion to a close. Next year, Bezrat Hashem, we're going to learn about the rebellion and the war and the remaining chapters of Sefer Shmuel. Bezrat Hashem, that is the job remaining. But for now, we will adjourn for the duration of the summer. I'm going to stop there.